We invite you all to take a step forward towards the risk and pay respect to the victims of the genocide against the Tutsi. Please take a moment of reflection as the military band plays the reveille.
Biggest stadium where most of the commemorative events are going to be taking place. Dozens of heads of states are in Kigali as we speak, including Ethiopia's Abiy Ahmed and South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, they're going to come to this stadium later today, but right now they're on the other side of the city in the Kigali Genocide Memorial. That's where about 250,000 bodies are believed to be buried, and that's where Rwanda's President Paul Kagame is lighting the Flame of Remembrance, which will burn for 100 days. That's the amount of time it took for hundreds of thousands of Tutsis to be killed back in 1994.
Rwandans will never understand why any country would remain intentionally vague about who was targeted in the genocide. I don't understand it. Such ambiguity is, in fact, a form of denial, which is a crime in and of itself. And Rwanda will always challenge it.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you from the sunny climes of Western Japan here in May of 2024 with episode 459 of the Corbett Report podcast, The Rwandan Genocide is a Lie. Now, as I hope you have gathered, if not from your memory and experience, at least from the title and the introduction to today's exploration, we are here in May 2024, sitting in the midst of the 30th anniversary of the so-called 100 days of the so-called Rwandan genocide. And if you are like the average Westerner, you probably have a broad, vague conception of those events that have been gleaned from the mass media. And you know something about the fact that the 100 days refers to that 100-day window between April 7 and July 18 of 1994, in which, we are told, 800,000 Tutsis were slaughtered with reckless abandon, mostly hacked to death in grisly machete attacks by Hutu extremists in Rwanda in Africa. As I say, if you are like the average person, you have probably received all of your information about this event from mainstream news sources and, of course, Hollywood.
For 100 days in 1994, the African country of Rwanda suffered a horrific campaign of mass murder. Neighbor turned against neighbor as violence engulfed the region, resulting in the deaths of over one-tenth of the country's population.
Paul, thank you for coming. The air conditioner's on the blink. Is there any way you can have a look at it? I'm just on a deadline.
Definitely.
Thank you. Brad, let me know when you get the satellite feed. Thanks.
Mr. Fleming, I brought you some tea as well, sir.
Thank you, Paul. You're an oasis in the desert.
The elements in the government and the army are following the example of what happened to the Americans in Somalia. I think they intend to intimidate us, try to attack us, and hope that the West will pull all its troops out.
Do you think they'll succeed?
No, they won't. The UN's here to stay.
However, the outbreak of violence is shooting down of the president's plan.
What the hell do you think you're doing? I'm responsible for the safety of this crew. What is this?
Where did you get this? Half a mile down the road.
Fred, it's David. I've got incredible footage. It's a massacre. Dead bodies, machetes. If I get this through right away, can you make the evening news? Yeah. You have to lead with us.
10 years ago, in the small East African country of Rwanda, 800,000 people were slaughtered by their own government.
This was ordinary men, women, and children, and the only reason that they were killed was because they were Tutsi.
Virtually the entire world turned away and did almost nothing to stop the genocide.
In retrospect, it all looks very clear, but at the time, what was happening in Rwanda, the situation was unclear.
They cannot tell me that they didn't know. Everybody knew what was happening.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Rwanda's holding a week of commemorations marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, when up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias. During the genocide, at least 250,000 women were raped. As the world watched the horror unfold 30 years ago, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refused to help stop the killing. The Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, said in a speech Sunday, the international community, quote, failed all of us. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton traveled to Rwanda this week to mark the 30th anniversary of the genocide, along with other foreign dignitaries. As President Clinton refused to label the 1994 mass killings in Rwanda's genocide, he has since said his failure to respond was one of his biggest regrets of his presidency.
Men who were there said the killers were working together, the gendarmerie and the local civilians. Methodical is the word they used.
It's extermination, General, like the Jews.
Genocide getting underway, but we didn't know to call it that yet.
As I say, to the extent that the average person on the street knows anything at all about the so-called 100 days of the so-called Rwanda genocide, it is almost inevitable that they have received that information from mainstream sources and/or Hollywood propaganda. And in a development that will not be at all surprising to Corbett reporteers, but may be surprising to people who fell off the turnip truck yesterday, as it turns out, all of that information is based on misinformation, disinformation, lies, propaganda, spin, and contextless information that points people in the wrong direction. Yes, the Rwandan genocide, as we know it, the story of the Rwandan genocide, is a lie. Now, let's be clear what is being stated here. I am not saying the Rwandan genocide was a hoax, that nothing happened in 1994, no one died. No, of course not. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps over a million people, absolutely did die in Rwanda, were murdered in Rwanda in 1994. And yes, there were Hutu extremists who did kill Tutsis, but there were also Tutsis that killed Hutus. There was much more going on, not only within that 100 days, but outside the bounds of that 100 days, that starts to paint a very different picture altogether. So to get a handle on this, you might start asking yourselves about some of the oddities of the Rwandan genocide that don't seem to conform to a typical genocide narrative. For example, isn't it a strange genocide that results in more deaths of the genociders than of the genocidees? Asterisk, the fact checkers may or may not agree with that statement, but it has certainly been suggested, and the identification of the 800,000, I guess, maybe, people who are alleged to have died in that 100 days is certainly an open question, and there are definitely those that assert there were more Hutus that were killed than Tutsis, which might suggest maybe this wasn't the genocide in the straightforward sense that we've been presented. And isn't it a strange genocide that results from a genocidal government backing these extremists, or at least on their side, that also contains within that government members of the genocide class in important cabinet positions? Isn't that a bit strange? And what is the result of this genocide? It results in the, by far, the minority population of the genocide. These, the people being genocided, right, end up taking power and have been in power now for 30 years. The scrappy band of rebel upstarts managed to overthrow the government that was genociding them and has now ruled as what is openly and officially known as and understood as by all parties, even the mainstream media would admit this, by a one-party dictatorial authoritarian government that has not changed hands in 30 years. Isn't that a strange turn of events? Yes, there are many ways that we could complicate this genocide narrative, but here's one that I find particularly handy, and I've had cause to employ in recent geopolitical kerfuffles of various sorts, because I think it is a good way of getting our handle on these sorts of things. It's the question of when do you start the clock? For example, with regards to the crisis in Gaza, do you start the clock? History began on October 7th, 2023. I mean, even assuming you swallow all of the lies that were told about what happened on that day wholesale and 100% believe the narrative presented to you of that day by the Jerusalem Post and BBC and CBS and everyone else, even if you did do that, do you start the clock on October 7th, 2023? There was some sort of prehistory of nothingness, and then October 7th, 2023, out of nowhere, is that how you understand what is happening in Gaza right now? Or how about, as I pointed out at the beginning of the Ukraine special military operation, don't call it a war or Putin will throw you in jail, back in 2022, as I said at the time, do you start the clock in February 2022, when out of the blue, with no context whatsoever, is that where we start the clock? What happens if we start the clock in, say, 2014? What happens if we start the clock in 2006? What if we start the clock in 2004? What if we start the clock back in the 1900s? The 1800s? How about the year 1000? How far back do you go to really understand what is happening within a given conflict? Well, that's a valid question to ask, and I think particularly pertinent in a genocide narrative that is synonymous with this 100 days. Why the 100 days? Oh, okay, the killings really began on April 7th, 1994, and we can say definitively it was over by July 18th when the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, who are they exactly? Took over. Those valiant, plucky upstarts took over and have been in power ever since in a one-party authoritarian dictatorship. All right, so, but, let's see. What if we started the clock, I don't know, one day earlier? What if instead of the 100 days, it was the 101 days? Did anything of import happen on April 6, 1994? Oh, yeah, that's right. That's when the president of Rwanda was assassinated, and along with some of his key staff and officials. And essentially, effectively, the government of Rwanda didn't really exist during that subsequent 100 days. And oh, by the way, the RPF narrative, and the one that's propounded to the public, is that the RPF, these scrappy band of upstarts, who are they again, that came out of nowhere from the mists of time, they didn't start their operations, their what essentially were guerrilla military operations to overthrow the government of Rwanda. They didn't start that until April 8th, 9th, after the killings began. Those Hutus began going crazy all of a sudden for no reason and started killing Tutsis on April 7th. That's when... Oh, but that's actually a lie, too, as came out in subsequent events, including the International Tribunal for Rwanda, the criminal tribunal. As it turns out, no, actually, in addition to Paul Kagame of the RPF ordering the assassination of the Rwandan president, a disputed fact, but one that even the bastion of truthiness, Wikipedia and their types of sources will hand-wring about, well, it may have been the RPF, it may not have been, who knows, whatever. Well, it was Paul Kagame and the RPF that brought down the Rwandan president, and the same night was when the RPF began its military invasion, began attacking Rwandan governmental forces, which again came out in the International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda decades later, but whatever. History schmistery, right? So how about if we started the clock on April 6, 1994? Does that create a different picture of what took place within the 100 days? But why start the clock there? Why not start the clock back and say, I don't know, October 1st, 1990, when the RPF, the Ugandan Army, which, by the way, is what the RPF was, and there may be historical reasons for that if you go further back in time, but at any rate, the Ugandan Army invaded Rwanda, starting what became known as the Rwandan Civil War, perhaps a bit of a misnomer because it's an international cross-border civil war. Well, anyway, the Rwandan Civil War, which, oh, by the way, did you know there was a civil war that was raging from October 1990 up until that 100-day period? Maybe some of that had something to do with what was going on. Why start the clock there? How about 1959, the beginning of the Rwandan Revolution that overthrew the Tutsi monarchy and replaced it with a Hutu-led, but not Hutu-exclusive government, because there were certainly Tutsis in important positions in that government. Certainly at the time of the so-called 100 days, there were Tutsis in important positions of power that, again, creates a very different narrative. Why start the clock there? How about back in 1890, back in colonial settler times, when the Tutsi-Hutu distinction was reinforced and invigorated by the colonial settlers? But why start the clock there? Why not start back in the 18th century when Hutus and Tutsis already existed? It wasn't a racial or ethnic category. It wasn't a tribal thing. It was a class distinction that was made that was essentially a wealth distinction, which was more or less evaluated by cattle ownership. If you were a wealthy cattle owner, you were part of the Tutsi elite, and the Tutsi elite ruled over the Hutus, everyone else. And you could become a Tutsi, admittedly a rare event, but you could become a Tutsi by gaining wealth, i.e. gaining cattle. You could become from a Tutsi, you could become a Hutu by losing your wealth. These sorts of things are not peripheral parts of the story. They are essential to even beginning to get a grasp of what the Rwanda genocide really was. Spoiler, it wasn't a genocide. That is not the right way to think of it. Yes, hundreds of thousands of people died, but it was not a genocide in the straightforward way that it is portrayed. As I say, in order to start understanding this information, you have to start interrogating the history, looking at that wider context than the 100 days that we are presented with. So let's do that. And luckily, we don't have to go very far from home here at the Corbett Report in order to do that. Yes, as longtime listeners, I sincerely hope will know, I have talked about this issue before, quite specifically around the time of the 20th anniversary of these events, 10 years ago in 2014, I talked to, for example, Keith Harmon Snow, a photojournalist, a war correspondent, someone who has traveled and written extensively about various military and outside manipulations and machinations in Africa, but also very specifically on the so-called Rwandan genocide. And I will put a link into some of his work on that so that you can acquaint yourself with it. But let's listen to a bit of that interview in which Keith Harmon Snow explains this historical background in order to give us the context for understanding not only the lies of the Rwandan genocide and how they have been perpetrated and perpetuated in the mainstream media and in the consciousness of the Western public for decades now, but why exposing those lies, why understanding those lies are extremely important for us, all of us, in the Western world and here in Japan and elsewhere going forward. We are going to talk today about the Rwandan genocide of 1994, and of course we are in the midst here in May 2014, in the midst of the 20th anniversary of the so-called 100 Days, which has been talked about and touched upon a little bit in the mainstream media, and generally, unfortunately, most people's understanding either comes from mainstream reporting on this subject, or from, more likely, sources like Hollywood picks like Hotel Rwanda and things of that sort. And so people, I think, generally have some sort of understanding of this as something that was perpetrated by extremist Hutus against Tutsis and moderate Hutus, and somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Rwandans were killed during that 100-day period, and it was all put to an end by Paul Kagame and the RPF, who came in and saved the day, or something along those lines, seems to be the narrative that most people took out of this. And just about every part of that narrative is wrong in some respect, and of course in some respects it's 180 degrees from the truth. So in order to start deconstructing this, perhaps we can start at sort of the roots of the conflict and people's understanding of Hutus and Tutsis and all of this as just another African tribal conflict. Let's start talking about the actual power structure that existed there in Rwanda and exists today, and the historical roots of this 100 days.
Well, the power structure that exists today is the Rwanda was brought to power. Paul Kagame, the current president, was brought to power by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. The military guerrilla campaign began on October 1st, 1990, culminated in the double presidential assassinations of the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi on April 6, 1994, the so-called beginning of the so-called 100 days. And the Rwandan Patriotic Front seized power in a coup d'etat backed by the United States, Britain, and Israel. The four-year civil war culminated in, as I said, this conclusion on July 15th, the end of the 100 days. And the Rwandan Patriotic Front has had power since then. And this is a criminal regime, as criminal can be. You think of some of the worst dictators we've ever heard of in the past. For example, Augusto Pinochet from Chile. Or give me somebody else, you know, Hitler. I mean, more people have been killed because of Paul Kagame than the guy we know as Adolf Hitler. And that is not an understatement by any sense of the imagination. And it also sounds kind of like, you know, if Keith Harmon Snow would say that, this guy must be crazy. You know, he's comparing this guy, Paul Kagame, to Hitler. Well, that's not what I've heard. What I've heard is that Rwanda is the Switzerland of Africa today. The business climate is fantastic, and they're growing coffee. You can buy fair trade coffee at Starbucks, and it's safe, and they stopped the genocide. And there's reconciliation between Hutus and Tutsis being brought about by the Rwandan government. All of that is absolute nonsense. The government of Rwanda today is a criminal regime that has been engaged in extortion, conspiracies to murder and assassinate people outside of Rwanda and inside of Rwanda, in Europe, in the United States, in South Africa, with the most recent assassination in Kenya, for example. The government of Rwanda today, if you can call them a government, has been involved in extortion, conspiracies, mass murder in the Congo, genocide in Rwanda, genocide in Uganda before they came to power in Rwanda, genocide in Rwanda itself, genocide in the Congo, and they're also involved in the genocidal campaigns going on in Sudan. So, and they've been involved in the criminal racketeering and extortion and absolute robbery in the Congo of the raw materials, in the Eastern Congo in particular. Most people, or some people, have heard about the fact that the coltan, columbium tantalite, is used in our cell phones, Sony PlayStations, laptop computers, and that this comes from Eastern Congo, and that this is responsible for the conflict in Eastern Congo, and in Eastern Congo that, you know, it's the rape capital of the world. These are other partial truths and partial misconceptions advanced by the propaganda system to cover up or create what is otherwise basically the falsification of consciousness, the falsification of Western consciousness. What really happened in Rwanda began with the Tutsis assuming power in, I don't even know, 1750 or 1850 but by 1890, the Tutsi kings in Rwanda were in control. These were cattle herders. The Tutsi elites were cattle herders, and the Hutu masses and it's 80% Hutu, 20% Tutsi in Rwanda then and now. And the Hutu masses were the serfs, the slaves, the agriculturalists. They were then, of course, the colonial apparatus was mapped over Rwanda in 1890, beginning in 1890, where Germany took control. But people have to understand that this is not a tribal. Hutu and Tutsi are not tribal constructs. For example, you could become a Hutu by losing all your cattle, which makes it clear that it's an economic thing. It's an economic and a social status thing. It's not anything having to do with tribe. You could also gain cattle and become a Tutsi, although that was very, very rare. To go from the masses to the elites was very rare, but it did happen. More common was to lose all your cattle and go from the elites to the masses. So the Tutsi elites are the people we need to be concerned with. The Tutsi elites are the people that committed genocide in Rwanda in 1994. The Tutsi elites, if people are listening and this scrambles the brain in the Western mind who's been so deeply propagandized, because you can't hear the Tutsi elites are responsible for genocide in Rwanda in 1994 when you've been given all this propaganda before that tells you that the Tutsis are the victims and the Hutus are the killers. The Tutsi elites are the killers. The Tutsi elites slaughtered Hutu people from October 1st, 1990 until the middle of 1994, and they continue to perpetrate genocide in Rwanda to this very moment, for example, through policies of forced sterilization of Hutu males in Rwanda today. They're also still hunting down Hutu people all over the world. And we could go into that, but it's peripheral. The point is the Tutsi elites in 1890 were in control of the masses. It was not a tribal thing. Germany came along, mapped the colonial apparatus over Rwanda and Burundi. And after the end of World War I, Germany lost control of, because of the reshuffling of power after that, Germany lost control and Belgium took control of Rwanda and Burundi. And Belgium also had control of the Congo. King Leopold slaughtering, you know, the red rubber trade, all this that people can easily learn about. 10 million killed in the 10 years of King Leopold's reign and that sort of thing. And Belgium seized control and then perpetuated the stereotyping of Hutu and Tutsi people and basically used the word again, mapped it onto a tribal construct, which becomes part of the white mentality of thinking about Africa as something that has to do with Tarzan and Jane, which was all created in 1938 by Edgar Rice Burroughs. But the groundwork was laid long, long before by a guy named Henry Morton Stanley. And most white people know the story that goes like this. Henry Morton Stanley searched for this guy Livingstone. He found him in the continent somewhere, and he came up to him and he said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." There's nothing about that story that has any truth to it either. Henry Morton Stanley was an agent for the Belgian king. He went into the Congo and set up the red rubber trade. They, you know, butchered entire villages to make sure that they met their quota. They cut children and people's hands off. You know, they raped women. They took women away from the men to lure the men out of the jungle and then turn them into slaves, etc. This is what Henry Morton Stanley did. And his books began the white tribal representation of Africa that persists and has been used by the imperial apparatus to continue to falsify the consciousness of people about Africa so that we can exploit the place. And what are we talking about? Exploitation, diamonds and gold and rubber and copper and tin and manganese and oil and methane and plantations for coffee, cocoa. I said rubber, palm oil. You know, it goes on. The list goes on and on. But the biggest profitable business in Africa today is the misery industry. The CARE, UNICEF, UNHCR, World Vision, you know, Save the Children. That's the biggest business in Congo by far, over and above all of the most valuable mineral commodities and agricultural commodities, even water. So back to the subject of Hutus and Tutsis, just to conclude the point that the Belgian colonial apparatus put in place the system which further exacerbated the problems between Hutu and Tutsi people. But the Hutu people were the oppressed people until 1959 when they, with the support of Belgian Catholic priests and the Catholic Church, who saw that Hutu people were not getting a fair and just education, educated enough Hutus in what I believe was liberation theology, and the Hutu people set about, like black people all over the world in seeking their liberation, but their immediate oppressors were the Tutsi people. Not the Tutsi people, I take that back, the Tutsi elites, because there were plenty of ordinary average Tutsi people who also were oppressed under the Tutsi elites, not as badly. So by 1959, 1960, there was a social revolution. The Hutu people overthrew the Tutsi apparatus. Belgium saw the way the wind was blowing and changed its support from the Tutsi elite to the Hutu elite at this point. And then all of these Tutsi elites who had been basically running the slave trade, the slavery in Rwanda, were forced out of Rwanda. They fled for their lives, quite clearly. They just like the Tibetan Buddhist monarchy fled from Tibet with the Dalai Lama. They took all the gold, they took all the money, they fled, and they left the serfs behind because it was not in Rwanda, it was not safe for the Tutsi elites after the Hutus assumed the power structure. So the Tutsi elites then fled to Uganda, the United States, Belgium, some to Kenya, a few to Tanzania, etc., but mostly Uganda, United States, Belgium, UK. And then they started screaming bloody murder. They started screaming that they were the oppressed people. They were oppressed by the Belgians, and it was great. It was a great story. It looked perfect. The Belgians oppressed the Tutsi elites. This is a story they took to the non-aligned movement. We had the United States and USSR and the non-aligned movement, the countries like Brazil and India and Malaysia. And they went to the non-aligned peoples, peoples of color, who are fighting for their own liberation from the imperial apparatus and colonial structures all over the world. And they said, we're oppressed, we're oppressed. And they got all this funding and all this backing and were able to buy arms and go back and attack the Hutu power structure in Rwanda from 1960 until 1972. The Tutsi elites were the perpetrators of violence. But every time they went back and attacked Rwanda, Hutu people within Rwanda would retaliate and commit atrocities. And the Tutsi people in Rwanda were the victims, very clearly the victims of this. But the Tutsi elites would come in, hit and run, go back. And they called themselves cockroaches. They called themselves, the word is Inyenzi in Kinyarwanda, and it translates to cockroach. And this was something that the Rwandan Patriotic Front was very proud of. They would strike under cover of night. They would bomb buses. They would bomb nightclubs in Rwanda. Long before 1990, they would bomb the civil apparatus and create terrorism in Rwanda to destabilize the country under the previous succession of Hutu presidents. So in 1973, this guy Juvenal Habyarimana, who lasted from 73 till April 6, 1994, he was assassinated. I'm sorry, I meant he was assassinated April 6, 1994. He assumed power in a coup in 1973 backed by France. France boots the Belgians. France takes control, uses Habyarimana as their man, backs the Hutu power structure, and France is now the big money maker, using Rwanda for their own purposes. And of course, the United States is to Latin America as France was to Africa. The United States and Latin America had all these colonial and imperial missions and CIA operations, and France had the same thing in Africa, and we were way behind in Africa as far as that goes. Even Britain was second to France, but they were way behind, and then Belgium and Germany. But France had all of these countries. Francophone Africa was huge. It's Mali and Burkina Faso and Togo and Benin and Cameroon and Gabon and Central African Republic and Chad, all these countries, and they wanted and took Rwanda. And so they had their little satellite over here. They had the Belgians had Zaire or Congo, and France was able to use Rwanda as a base for power operations on the continent from 1973 until 1994. So France does play some role in what happened. What we always hear is that France was responsible for the genocide in Rwanda, or we're hearing this often. We hear that France has not been held to account for their participation in the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda. So that's the summary of the, you know, the Hutu-Tutsi relationship brings you up to 1990, where Hutus were a majority in power in Rwanda in 1990 when the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the Tutsi elites, backed by Washington, Israel, and Britain, invaded. And that was one of the primary illegal acts of the century, because the October 1st, 1990 invasion of Rwanda set the stage for the double presidential assassination in 1994, all of the killings between 1990 and 1994, the killings of the Tutsi people in 1994, and then the multiple genocides that the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the Tutsi elites, committed in the Congo. And to conclude the point between the Tutsi and the Hutu, the tribal, the relationship that's more social or economic, the Hutu people in Rwanda were the majority from 1990 to 1994, for example. They were forced from the north to the capital, Kigali, to the tune of 1.2 million internally displaced people living in refugee camps by April 6, 1994. The Tutsis who stayed behind in 1960, 1973, etc., they were French-speaking Tutsis. The Tutsis that left became English-speaking Tutsis, mostly in Uganda. These were not even Rwandans anymore. They were always billed as the victims, a stateless people, a people without a country, the Jews of Africa. This is part of the propaganda system, part of the propaganda official narrative about genocide in Rwanda, that the Tutsis are the Jews of Africa. We have to have sympathy for them. They're a stateless people. They deserve to be in control of Rwanda. But none of this makes any sense. You think about it. The Tutsis invaded Rwanda. There was a double presidential assassination. We can talk about who was responsible for that. It was Kagame and the RPF. But in any case, there was a double presidential assassination. The Tutsis are the victims of genocide. Somewhere, and the number is actually 800,000 to 1.5 million Tutsis killed, victims of genocide. But they win the war, and they're in power today, when there were only 20% minority previously. So you look at the numbers, and some professors from the United States went to Rwanda, started looking at the numbers, and immediately concluded that it was impossible that all of those Tutsis were killed. So if there were 800,000 to 1.5 million bodies, who are they? If they're not Tutsis, they're Hutus. There's hundreds of thousands of Tutsi bodies, but there was more than hundreds of thousands of Hutu bodies. So who are the victims here? The Hutus or the Tutsis? The Hutus are the victims. The Tutsi elites who spoke English, the Ugandans, some Americans, were the perpetrators. And the next tier, another tier of victims, because we have a hierarchy of victimhood, the Hutu masses, the Tutsi masses in Rwanda. The Tutsi French speakers were the victims of genocide in 1994. But they were acts of genocide. There's no evidence at the International Criminal Tribunal that there was any organization of conspiracy to commit genocide, any planification, they call it planification of genocide, by the Hutu government. Because on April 6, 1994, the president and his chief of staff were assassinated. The government was decapitated, and the prime minister, her name was Agatha, I can't remember her last name, she was immediately assassinated, and that was because the RPF wanted to get her out of the way too. And so then there's no government. You can't say the government of Rwanda committed genocide from April to July of 1994 because there was no government. It had been completely decapitated. So there was no organization. There was no planning. But there were plenty of Tutsis around, and there were plenty of Hutu people, and these Hutu people had seen. Their history was a history of bloodshed and oppression for hundreds of years, and they'd seen their people forced from the north, villages completely wiped off the face of the earth, women raped, people massacred, people lured into meetings by the RPF before 1994, told that this was going to be a meeting to deal with democracy, to bring democracy to Rwanda, and then they were just butchered. And where was the international press? The international press was supporting the RPF story because the RPF story was being put out by people in Washington, D.C. and people in Israel. And we could name some people, a Mossad agent, David Kimchi in particular, and an American intelligence operative named Roger Winter, who were responsible for organizing the psychological operations and the invasion of the country, which the RPF did. And of course, if people have failed to conclude that this makes some sense, but Paul Kagame was trained at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, which is the U.S. Army Command and Staff College or something like that, and they train people like Kagame in an American military in several key things. One, how to invade a country as a guerrilla force, and two, how to create psychological operations to win your war. So that was a long answer to your question.
It was,
but it gives people a little bit more of the true story of what really happened in Rwanda, and we haven't even begun to scratch the surface.
Well, that was an absolute data dump of information, so I hope you have your pen and paper by your side. At any rate, you can always go back and re-listen to that interview, or more importantly, listen to the entire interview, which of course is preserved on CorbettReport.com. And you can go and listen as Keith Harmon Snow continues to expand on that story and talks, for example, about the World Bank IMF role in that genocide, in the slaughter, at any rate, that took place in Rwanda in 1994, and the political economy of the genocide industry, etc. There's some incredibly important information contained in that interview, so I will commend it to your attention. But let's move on, because there's plenty more to deconstruct. Yes, okay, great. Historical background context, so we can start to understand that what was happening in Rwanda there in 1994 didn't start in 1994, and it wasn't simply about Rwanda. It was about a much bigger picture with historical background and roots, and of course, meddling from outside powers, Israel, US, and others. Surprise, surprise. Well, maybe not so surprising. And we could continue deconstructing not just that sort of historical background and context to widen out our understanding of this so-called genocide, but to drill down on the details of these 100 days and what did or didn't happen during those 100 days. For example, we could talk about the fact that the government, the Rwandan government, abandoned the capital on April 12th and then asked the RPF to help them to restore order, asking for a ceasefire, saying, please help us restore order in the streets, an offer that was rejected by Paul Kagame and the RPF. Or we could talk about the Tutsi prince, the son of the previous Tutsi king, a well-known figure and well-respected figure, generally speaking, in Rwanda, Antoine Nyatira, who testified at the aforementioned International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda in 2007 that it was the RPF, the supposed scrappy underdog rebel forces, that were the protagonists and heroes at the end of the day of Hotel Rwanda and other propaganda surrounding the Rwanda genocide myth. This Tutsi king, again, part of the genocided class, right, testified at the ICTR in 2007 that the RPF had done the killing, all the killing, and not the government, and that he was a witness to it. A testimony that was so startling and so flew in the face of the very groundwork and framework and ethos of that ICTR that the judges then conspired with the defense counsel, with the prosecutors, to get that testimony stricken from the record, which was later exposed by a lawyer by the name of Christopher Black, who we'll be hearing from in a moment. But first of all, let's go back to the types of things, the types of lies, the specific lies that we can identify that pertain to this genocide myth as it has been propounded over the years. And a name that will no doubt resonate for Canadians, at least of a certain vintage in the crowd. You, like I do, you will remember Romeo Dallaire, General Romeo Dallaire, leading the UN peacekeeping force that was inserted into Rwanda just months before everything went to hell in a handbasket. And if you grew up on that propaganda, you will know the story of General Dallaire and shake hands with the devil, and how Dallaire is the poster boy of the hero who tried to do what was right and did his best. And of course, he appears in Hotel Rwanda, played by Nick Nolte. And he was the valiant UN peacekeeper, just doing the best he could. But it was the outside meddling of the international community and their lack of response tied his hands. He couldn't do anything. He watched as all of this took place and has had to deal with the grief and the guilt of that ever since. He's become a very, very well-known speaker. But there's one interesting aspect of the Dallaire story that, interestingly enough, didn't really feature in the early reporting of this story, but became a absolute bedrock of the Rwandan genocide story in later years, thanks to the work of an interesting and enterprising reporter for The New Yorker, Philip Gourevitch, who wrote an article about this. It's what I have in my hands here. The genocide facts. Obviously a reproduction here, but you'll probably know about this part of the story. The facts that Dallaire sent to the UN, on January 11th, 1994, 3 months before the clock started and history began on April 7th, 1994, warning that there was going to be some kind of genocide. This is brought up as I say, in almost every discussion of the Rwanda genocide these days.
Tell me about this guy. Make it make sense.
This Jean-Pierre is a leader of the Interahamwe.
Very high up. He takes his orders directly from the head of the ruling party. He says they asked him to locate all the Tutsis living in Kigali and then make a list of their addresses.
Every Tutsi in Kigali?
He says then he realized that there's going to be a slaughter of the innocents. And his conscience cannot accept that. He says his mother is a Tutsi. He says they are organized to kill 1,000 Tutsis every 20 minutes.
General Dallaire sent this cable to UN headquarters in New York, warning that his informant has been ordered to register all Tutsi in Kigali. He suspects it is for their extermination. The informant described a major weapons cache which General Dallaire intended to raid. It is our intention to take action within the next 36 hours. Kofi Annan, concerned about the safety of Dallaire's limited UN force, responded, "We cannot agree to the operation contemplated, as it clearly goes beyond the mandate."
Well, there were the first thing is, of course, when I got information from the Interahamwe leader who told us what was being planned, and my desire to conduct military operations to throw off those who wanted to undermine the process by raiding their arms caches, because remember there was an arms embargo also. And so that sort of situation that was being created in the January timeframe also gave a warning to people that we were aware that these frictions could lead to something catastrophic, but nobody really believed it.
So he goes and meets Jean-Pierre, and Jean-Pierre tells him basically all of this information that's in this code cable. The most shocking one is, Interahamwe has trained 1,700 men in RGF military camps outside the city, 1,700 scattered in groups of 40 throughout Kigali. He goes through the training of the militia. He goes through...
As I say, you probably have heard of this genocide facts before, and if you're a Canadian, at least a Canadian who is old enough to remember, you will definitely have heard about this facts and the implications that flow from this facts. They knew beforehand, he had been warning and pleading and begging, but the international community just wouldn't do anything. That narrative, as I say, was really first reported on and popularized by Philip Gourevitch in the pages of The New Yorker in May of 1998 in an article entitled, unimaginatively enough, The Genocide Facts, which gives sort of the basic background of this fax and the details. The famous fax is dated January 11th, 1994, 3 months before the state-sponsored genocide in which members of the Hutu majority massacred at least 800,000 people from the Tutsi minority and also tens of thousands, blah, 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 official narrative. The fax, headed Request for Protection for Informant, was sent by Major General Romeo Dallaire, the UN force commander in Rwanda, to peacekeeping headquarters in New York. And it reported in startling detail the preparations that were underway to carry out precisely such an extermination campaign. Dallaire's informant was a former member of the security staff of President Juvenal Habyarimana, Rwanda's Hutu dictator. At the time of the facts, the informant was being paid about $1,000 a month, a kingly wage in Rwanda, by Habyarimana's political party to compile lists of Tutsis and to train the militiamen known as the Interahamwe, those who attack together, to kill them. Dallaire, a Quebecois, wrote as he speaks in a clipped military English, and his telegraphic prose underscored the urgency of his message. The peace that his UN blue helmets were in Rwanda to keep was a fiction. Throughout the early 90s, government-sponsored massacres of Tutsis had become a regular occurrence, and Habyarimana's political and military cronies, whose ideology was known simply as Hutu power, wanted them to continue. Their plan, according to Dallaire's informant, was once again to provoke a civil war, and as part of that plan, Belgian troops, who formed the backbone of the UN force, were to be provoked, and if Belgian soldiers resorted to force, a number of them were to be killed, and thus guarantee Belgian withdrawal from Rwanda. In the meantime, Dallaire's informant had been ordered to register all Tutsi in Kigali, and Dallaire wrote, "He suspects it is for their extermination. Example he gave was that in 20 minutes, his personnel could kill up to 1,000 Tutsis." Okay. You can go on reading that. Of course, the link will be in the show notes, along with absolutely everything else I am reading, citing, talking about today. You could continue that with Unredacted from the National Security Archive, their blog. They had a post up on January 9th, 2014, the Rwanda Genocide Facts Deconstructed. They had an entire series of documents, a tranche of documents related to this fax and its reception that they released at that time in January of 2014, the Rwanda Genocide Facts, What We Know Now. So you can find out a lot of information about this fax, but I'll tell you something that you won't find in any of those reports or any of the subsequent talking or reporting about this genocide fax, which is the Dallaire genocide fax is a fabrication? Well, that's the contentious claim of Christopher Black. Well, who on earth is Christopher Black? As you may or may not know, but you should know, Christopher Black was a Toronto-based criminal lawyer who was contacted by one of the defendants at the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, specifically General Augustin Ndindiryamana, who was being charged with genocide? Participation in genocide? Question mark? In fact, the whole story of the indictment of Ndindiryamana and what it did and did not contain, including specific charges of actual crimes, parts of the indictment were blacked out, so it was literally impossible for the defense counsel to even determine if their charges were included in this 65-page propaganda rant that was framed as an indictment. It was a remarkable trial with weird twists and turns. But as I say, Ndindiryamana contacted Christopher Black, a Toronto-based criminal lawyer, in the year 2000 to help represent him as defense counsel at the ICTR, which Black ultimately ended up accepting that invitation and taking on what became a years-long journey involving all sorts of twists and turns where Black had a front-row seat to what was happening in the courtroom, the testimony that was coming out in these trials, what the crazy shenanigans of secret deals between the judges and the prosecutors, and all of this incredible information that did not get reported in the mainstream, but was reported on by Black himself in various outlets, and I will throw in some of the appropriate articles, etc., into the show notes, but perhaps most importantly for the purposes of today's exploration, my interview that I conducted with Christopher Black about that trial of Augustin Ndindiryamana that I conducted in May of 2014, and once again, Keith Harmon Snow and that interview, extremely important, a ton of information. The Christopher Black interview, even longer and even more information, just a complete data dump of information. So if you have not explored that conversation before, if you have not listened to that interview, I wholeheartedly encourage you to go and listen to that full interview. It is absolutely jam-packed with information. I think it is up there with some of the most important interviews I've conducted in the 17 years I've been doing this research. So I would strongly suggest you have a listen to that interview. But of the many, many incredible, surprising, profound, interesting things that Black raised during that interview, one of them is the idea that this infamous genocide fax is a doctored document that ultimately the prosecution at the ICTR had to abandon and stop bringing up and stop mentioning, because the provenance of this fax and the way in which this document was altered and then inserted into the record became a bit too uncomfortable for them.
Well, I wrote to a Chicago journalist last night. It makes you psychologically ill in a way, because it's very frustrating to know that facts were brought out in these trials proving that all this is wrong. And that even the judges agree with it, because all the judges in all the trials where people have been charged with conspiracy to commit genocide, the government ministers or the army, have all been found not guilty of those charges. And yet they put out the story that people had been convicted of that when it was not true. And I'll give you one example of the propaganda which began on the anniversary, 20th anniversary, was about the genocide facts, so-called, allegedly sent by General Dallaire to warn of this planned massacre of Tutsis. This is an important story because it shows how the propaganda system works and how people's minds in the West are manipulated to accept these wars. The General Dallaire, in 1995, in an interview, I think, on CTV Network, was asked, did he think there was a genocide, a planned genocide? He said no. At that time, he said, this is, I think, June or July 1995, that it was quite clear that the killings were spontaneous, you know, by the population because of fear and all sorts of things going on. There was no plan to it. In 2006, Alison DeForge, who wrote the book, The Bible on the so-called genocide, leading them to tell the tale, changed her stance and testified in her trial that the idea that the government of Rwanda had planned genocide was absurd. She said, A, it was not a Hutu government, it was a mixed Hutu and Tutsi government, because several Tutsis held several key ministries and they were close to the RPF, these people. So she said the idea that the Rwandan government could plan to kill Tutsis was absurd because it contained Tutsis within it, and the army also had Tutsis in among its ranks. The army and the gendarmerie had significant numbers of Tutsis. And those Tutsis stayed with the army and the gendarmerie all the way through the war. In fact, my General Ndili Yamana, my client, his close personal protection unit was composed entirely of Tutsi officers. So it's absurd to say that they would put up with their commander committing genocide when they were members of his team. And she also testified that Kagame's claim that his forces acted to stop genocide, she said, that's a complete myth. Now, that, because she said all he wanted was complete power, and the idea he acted to stop genocide was a myth. Now, this is startling testimony from the woman who actually started the whole story, was contributed to the entire propaganda structure we now have. She retracted, stepped back from that, and actually stated something opposite. But it was never reported in the press. The BBC was covering the trials and never reported that testimony. It's never been quoted since. Then we have the genocide facts. When our trial began, that facts was one of the central planks of the prosecution case against all the accused in our trial and in the Military One trial. In the Military One trial, the defense counsel cross-examined General Dallaire on that fax, but they took the position that it existed, but the informant was not reliable, so it was false information. It was. The informant was an RPF agent. But we found out that, in fact, the fax never existed. It was never sent as such. Now, what got me onto that was, when disclosure, they gave us a copy of the fax, which is the one that you see published by Philip Gorovitch and so on and so forth, and was republished by the New York Times back a couple of months ago. If you look at that fax closely, there are certain physical things on it, and the flow of the language makes you pause and question the document, because the title of the document is not warning planned murder of Tutsis or Belgian soldiers. It was just a request for protection of informant. The fax is numbered 1 through 13, paragraphs 1 through 13, but paragraph 12 is missing. There is no paragraph 12. The flow of the language doesn't make sense. It's incoherent because certain paragraphs talk about allegations made by this informant to the UN officers about arms caches hidden in different places. Then suddenly it switches to inserts seemingly out of place allegations there were the government was planning to kill Tutsis and kill Belgian soldiers. And just the way it was inserted into the document didn't look right to me. It didn't feel right. So I became curious that maybe the document was not what we thought it was. So I actually wrote to New York UN headquarters and asked to have a copy of the original in their files. And they sent it to me. surprisingly, who sent it to me, and it's not the same document. What on the original document, it has the same paragraphs, but on the first page, there are notes which say, this document did not appear in UN files until November 28, 1995. Before that, it did not exist in UN files. And there are several notes to that effect on the document. There is also a fax number which provided the source from which it was sent into the UN files in New York in 1995. We tracked that number, a telephone, and it had a name attached to it, R.M. Connaughton, C-O-N-N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N. We tracked that number. It turns out it's the phone number for Colonel Richard M. Connaughton at Camberley Military Establishment in Britain, which is the home of Sandhurst Military Academy, which is like West Point or in the United States. And it also, that base also has several other intelligence establishments located there. So the fax was actually placed in New York in UN headquarters files on November 28, 1995, sent in by a British Army colonel. Now, what they had done is then photocopied that by whiting out all that information, that it's a fax source and the notes on it saying it didn't exist before that time. They had erased all those notes and marks and then photocopied it and presented the blank, the document with all those things removed, as the original. And that's the one that Gourevitch is using. Now, who gave it to him, I'd like to know, because nobody knows. So when the prosecution, so it was quite clearly, somebody had doctored that document between New York and Arusha, and obviously between New York UN headquarters and Philip Gourevitch's fax machine. So when the prosecution signaled they were going to introduce the document as a piece of evidence in the trial, we told the judges that we wanted to object to that. Now, how it happened was they called a Colonel Kleiss, who was at the time of 1994 had been a major in the Belgian army, and he was one of the men with Colonel Marshall who interviewed this informant, who allegedly said there were weapons caches and so on. During his cross-examination, the prosecution used him to put in this document into the trial. So they used him as a witness to introduce the document. We objected, and the judges asked why. We said, well, the document they got is not the original document. The one they've got in New York is this one, and we showed them. They were shocked. We then cross-examined Colonel Kleiss, and Colonel Kleiss had testified in 1995 to the Belgian military judge, because they were investigating the death of Belgian soldiers, that the facts that he drafted with Colonel Marshall, it was not General Dallaire that drafted it, it's those two guys, talked only about allegations by this informant that there were some secret arms caches. It did not mention killing of Tutsis or killing of Belgian soldiers. He testified to the same effect to the Belgian investigating judge, who's also investigating separately his own investigation to the death of the Belgian soldiers, the same thing. In 1997, he testified under oath before the Belgian Senate, because the Belgian government was having its own investigation. He testified then that the facts that they sent contained nothing except allegations of arms caches, nothing about killing or genocide, or killing anybody. Now, in the trial, he'd been obviously coached to say something different. So he said, well, with the facts I sent did say that. So we cross-examined him. Well, you said this then, you said this then, you said this then. Isn't that correct? Yes, it's correct. Yes, it's correct. Yes, it's correct. And then you say now that the informant told you about killing Tutsis in Belgium. Yes, well, we got your notes. So we had all the notes given to us of the interviews these officers conducted with the informant. It went over several weeks between January and March 1994. In none of those interviews, and the notes are extensive, does the informant ever tell them that the government or anybody else or the army has a plan to kill Tutsis or to kill Belgian soldiers? It's not mentioned. It doesn't appear in the notes anywhere. So we put that to him, and he just collapsed. It's obvious. I can send you the cross-examination. But he collapsed. I mean, it was a mess. So I think we established clearly that document. They did send a fax the night of January 10th, 11th to New York. That fax informed New York that this informant alleges there's some three or four arms caches, he says, somewhere, they which were never found, by the way. And they just asked, he's demanding protection, can we protect him? Now, another indication that this fax, which they now say was sent, is a forgery, is that Kofi Annan and General Barea, all the replies to these faxes do not mention genocide. They just talk seemingly incoherently about weapons caches and tell General Dallaire he can't do these things. And people say, oh, the UN was incompetent, or they were negligent, or Kofi Annan was incompetent. Well, it's not so. He was actually responding to the actual facts they got, which only talked about weapons caches, and that's what they replied to. There are no replies in their faxes back to this, to General Dallaire, talking about this allegation of killing Tutsis, because that fax was never sent. So the fax that was sent has been taken out of UN files and replaced by this one, which was concocted in November 1995.
That is just absolutely stunning, and that right. This has formed the centerpiece of the argument for so many years and has been so unquestioningly taken. And when did this start to unfold? I mean, I know, for example, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation an article that you wrote back in 2005 about the Dallaire genocide facts, laying out many of these details. So this has been known for at least a decade now.
At least a decade, that's right. So this cross-examination took place in 2005, and that's when I wrote the article, because it was getting no play in the press at all. It wasn't reported. Just to back up a little bit, the reason it was, I think, produced in November 1995 is tied to two events. The UN, because it was criticized so much by all sorts of people for not doing enough in Rwanda, had done its own study, internal study, of all the faxes and cables sent between New York and Kigali during that period. They could find no document alerting anybody to any plan to kill Tutsis. They said no such document could be found, including this one. And that was a very thorough search. Secondly, that came out in November, 2 weeks before the fax appeared in New York. The UN report came out saying there's no such document indicating anything like that. On the same week, there was a conference held in Kigali called by Kagame about the so-called genocide. And one of the big problems, academics and people there were criticizing, well, where's the proof that the government or the army gave orders to or planned to kill Tutsis? Because there's you've got no radio intercepts, you've got no orders you've ever captured, there's no signals you've captured, there's no minutes of meetings of any such thing. There's no documentary proof whatsoever, as opposed to like the Nazis, we had lots of documentary proof that that's what they did. So there's nothing. Well, conveniently, 2 weeks after that conference, and 1 week after, I think, after the UN report was released, this document suddenly is placed in UN New York files and suddenly gets floated around. First in the London Observer by Lindsay Hilson. She was the first one to float it, was used to float it, Lindsay Hilson. For the London Observer, now she works for the BBC. And a Belgian reporter was used to float it into a Belgian press. It didn't seem to make much of a stir until 1997, 98, when Philip Gorovitch's article came out, resurfacing it and making a big splash about this fax. So in 2005, I got the original fax in 2004. It wasn't 2005 we could use it, and that's when I wrote the article. But yes, since 2005, this has been known, and and interestingly enough, since November 2005, that fact has never been mentioned at the ICTR ever again. It was completely dropped from the case. It's a complete embarrassment to the prosecution. So, although it was one of the central documents, they made a big noise about this document. It's never been mentioned since in their arguments or any other time.
For me, speaking as a Canadian who, as I say, very much grew up on the story, the mythos, of the hero, the Canadian peacekeeping hero, Romeo Dallaire, and the incredible importance of the genocide facts to our understanding of that story, that to me is just jaw-dropping, amazing, incredible information that has been out on the table for two decades now, and has been in the Corbett Report archives for a decade. But still, how many people know about that? The genocide facts itself is deeply in question, And as always, question and interrogate the sources and find out more information about what is being alleged and where this information is coming from. I will throw in addition, obviously, to exhorting you to check out the rest of that conversation with Christopher Black, which goes into much greater detail about every aspect of the information that he uncovered during his time at the ICTR. But specifically, on this fax, I will throw in the link to Christopher Black's article on it, The Dallaire Genocide Facts, A Fabrication, that I suggest you check out if you were interested in this story and deconstructing these myths and lies. But I guess, once again, we're back at the question of why. As I heard recently, when I dared to venture to talk about the incredible, important scramble for Africa that is taking place right now between China and America, I heard from one American, I don't care. What do I care about anything that's not happening in America? Well, if that is your opinion, well, it was nice not knowing you. But even for completely self-interested individuals, why might this history and understanding, truly understanding the lies, not just kind of generally, yeah, we're lied to about everything, but knowing specifically how these lies are perpetrated, the types of tactics and tricks that they use to perpetuate them and to propound them, why would we possibly want to know about that in order to break the staff of their lies, shove it in people's face to show them that they have been duped for decades, and to break the myth, break the spell of the narrative makers who make up myths and lies so that they can more easily sell their agenda to the public. What kind of agenda? Well, when and if you do go back and refamiliarize yourself, for example, with Hotel Rwanda, you will remember, you will discover quite quickly that the overwhelming propagandistic message of that film, the real reason why it exists, is not because of actual really caring about the people of Rwanda and what happened there and understanding the dynamics of that. Of course not. No, for the Hollywood audiences of something like Hotel Rwanda, what you really need is, well, what does this matter to us? And the whole point of that movie, over and over and over again, they stress, oh, it's just the international community. They're not stepping in. They won't do anything. Look at how ineffectual they are. Oh, they're all pulling out because they don't care about us. If they cared about us, they would come. We need their help. We need their intervention. They use that exact phrase numerous times throughout the movie. And that is the point. And that in the entire Rwandan genocide myth has been constructed and propped up for a number of reasons, but one important reason has been to sell the idea of the responsibility to protect R2P. It really got going on the back of this Rwandan genocide myth and pieces of that puzzle, like the genocide facts. You see, the valiant UN peacekeeper was warning and ringing the alarm bell, and they ignored him, and look what happened. That is the message of this propaganda. So let's just take one step back and ask ourselves, who was the hero, the protagonist of Hotel Rwanda again? Oh, right, Paul Rususa Begina, right? Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, the valiant manager of the Hotel Mille de Collines who saved 1,200 people. Well, that part of the story is true, but what happened after the story ended? Again, where do you start the clock? Where do you stop the clock? What happens if you roll that clock forward a few years? What was this hero of this big, if not Hollywood, at any rate, a big movie production? What became of him? What happened? Well, we can start getting some information of that from our old friends at the New York Times, the propaganda piece of paper of record. From this interesting article from 2021, he was the hero of Hotel Rwanda. Now he's accused of terrorism, which has an interesting section on someone that will be familiar to you by now. It says, Rusisi Begina articulated his position in a disjointed, interesting adjectival editorial intrusion into the narrative. Anyway, I will restart the sentence. Rusisi Begina articulated his position in a disjointed 2007 interview with Keith Harmon Snow, an American freelance journalist and self-described, again, editorial intrusion, self-described war crimes and genocide investigator. He insinuated that Kagame was the culprit behind the assassination of President Habyarimana and agreed with Snow that one motivation for the murder was to provoke a wave of killing and depopulate the country of much of the Hutu majority. Who benefited from Habyarimana's death? Rususa Begina said. It's Kagame and his people. he claimed that Tutsi fighters had infiltrated the Interahamwe militias and that some Hutu fighters were not aware that they, meaning the Interahamwe, were working for Kagame. Most of these guys who were just on the roadblocks were Kagame people. Other victims, he argued, were randomly targeted by enraged civilians who had been displaced during incursions by the Rwandan Patriotic Front from Uganda in the early 1990s. All those refugees who surrounded Kigali, who had been angry for 4 years, who had lost their family members, killed by the rebels, they started revenging on everyone. Hutu and Tutsi alike, he said. Kagame, he declared, is the one responsible for the death of 1 million people. Oh yeah, yeah, the star of Hotel Rwanda, the hero in this movie myth-making, he's not quite on the narrative anymore, so let's kind of get rid of him. And yeah, get rid of him indeed. In fact, that is a remarkable weird story as well that we can take not from the New York Times. Let's take it from Keith Harmon Snow himself, who wrote an article for Black Agenda Report, or was posted to Black Agenda Report. Hotel Rwanda hero kidnapped, another victim of Rwanda's grinding machine, which notes in a lengthy article that's worth your time, but it just notes here, a once revered citizen living in Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina, became one of Paul Kagame's fiercest critics in exile. On 27th of August 2020, Rusesabagina was lured to Dubai and kidnapped by the Rwandan government, renditioned from Dubai to Kigali in complete contravention of international laws and treaties. Even Rwanda's own penal code qualifies abduction and kidnapping as a serious and punishable offense. But hey, guys, it's okay if the state does it, right? I will end that quotation there, but that is a really fascinating, weird, horrific story in many ways. Literally, Rusesabagina lured to Dubai on false pretenses, then arrested and extradited to Kigali, where he then spent the subsequent 2 years in prison before finally being pardoned, or released at any rate. Paul Rusesabagina, Hotel Rwanda hero, set free March 25th, 2023. And you can read about the happy outcome of that story, which is crazy from a number of levels, one of which is it goes to show that, this Paul Kagame character, he was the valiant leader of this RPF, the plucky band of rebels that were the heroes of Hotel Rwanda, and Paul Kagame ends up literally arresting Rusesabagina as a terrorist, holding him just completely, flagrantly, blatantly making up his own law in order to hold this person for years in unlawful detention, and ultimately only released, as is pretty much universally acknowledged, because incredible outside pressure was being placed on Kagame and the Rwandan government to release him. Because, hey, this doesn't look so good for our narrative here. The star of Hotel Rwanda is imprisoned as a terrorist for years. But let me guess, and this isn't a slight at anyone, it's just, it should be one of those things that give you pause for thought. I bet you have at least heard of Hotel Rwanda, if not seen it. I bet you know something about the story of Rusesabagina and the Hotel Mille de Collines and all of that. But I bet you know nothing about his extraordinary rendition, kidnapping, set up on phony charges, political prosecutions, being held as a political prisoner for years. Did you know about that part? I wonder what Don Cheadle has to say about that. Again, that just goes to show how this works, and it shows how the utility of the Rwanda genocide lie for responsibility to protect and other agendas is only as good as we can kind of keep that narrative enshrined in people's memories as this. It's the 100 days. Don't ever look at anything that happened after the 100 days, like the 30 years of one state authoritarian dictatorship that has taken over. And now we have this Kagame guy who throws his political rivals into prison for whatever, at the drop of a hat, and he's clearly a dictator. And again, don't think of anything outside of the 100 days, guys. Well, it's time to break the spell of that myth. And there is so much more to say on this topic, as I hope, as I trust, you can start to glean even just from this presentation. But as always, I'm going to have to bring my presentation to a stop at some point. So let's bring it to that stopping point here, but not before exhorting all of the people in the audience, once again, to use this as the jumping off point for your own further exploration and research. There will be lots and lots of links in the show notes, the extensive documentation that is there for your perusal. I hope you will make use of that as the resource that it is. And as, again, I hope it is important to understand the details of these lies. Not just that we're lied to, but specifically how and why and by whom and for what purpose, so that we can show this to others, so we can break the spell of these narratives and start coming to a truer understanding, a more accurate understanding of history, reclaiming history so that we have an actual, true understanding of events, of the world around us, and how to proceed forward. That is the way to do honor to the legacy of the hundreds of thousands or million plus that died in Rwanda in those 100 days. That's going to do it for this edition of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, as always, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.